Welcome to another edition of The Ride Home with John and Kathy, live from the Salem, Pittsburgh studios. And now here are your hosts, John Hall and Kathy Emmons.
Hey, good afternoon. Greetings. Thanks for coming along. It is a sunny Thursday afternoon all day long. You see that yellow orb in the sky. Has it been a week since we've seen the sun?
Well, it seems like it's been a long time. I just think it's funny that when it's a sunny day, it's such a big bit of news.
Yay. It's an explosion of joy because I'm so tired of it, aren't you?
Yeah, of course. I'm so tired of it.
Feels very, very good.
Good grief. When I woke up, you know, I sleep with the curtains closed.
Yeah.
And I thought,
peeking out.
Is that sun peeking?
Oh, yeah, that's sun.
There?
Very nice.
Wow, it's really great.
Yep. Okay, Duquesne played some basketball today.
Yeah, but we're not looking.
We have no idea what's going on.
We're not looking.
Don't call us.
Nope.
Don't text us.
Nope.
Because we'll watch that later on this evening.
Now, I'm still bitter that Pitt's not in March Madness.
Yeah, of course. Yes, well, you should
or
be.
At least that Virginia is mm-hmm. in March Madness. But, you know, my husband's a Duquesne grad.
Oh.
And so we're staunchly behind them.
Is he wearing Duquesne swag today?
That's a good question. I don't know. He leaves very early in the morning, so I don't really have any idea.
You're peeking out the curtains a few hours later.
Exactly.
Yeah. Hey, but we did do our brackets.
We did. The Ride Home brackets are locked and loaded, and I feel particularly good about
mine. Do you? I'm like, did. Mm-hmm. Took me like 3 minutes.
Yeah.
I have
Lex,
no idea.
How good do you feel about yours?
I feel mediocre about it.
Mediocre. Okay. Who's your final victor?
Connecticut.
Connecticut?
Houston.
Yeah. Tennessee.
Okay, great. I'm glad we have different ones.
Me too.
That's
good.
Really, really good.
Right, and then Lex threw a little fly into the ointment there. The winner, or the loser, what's the deal here with the cookies?
First one out has to bake cookies for the entire office.
Yep.
That's what I offered.
First one out.
For the entire office?
Yeah, why not?
Oh, jeez.
Mm-hmm. No, I like
There's
that,
like
Lex.
Four of us here.
Exactly.
Can we just buy a bag of Oreos?
No.
We got to make them?
Yes.
Oh, come on.
Well, you keep saying how easy it is.
Oh, it's so easy. All right, fine.
Coming up on today's program in the 5 o'clock hour, more women are drinking themselves sick.
Hmm.
This is a thing that I saw developing online during COVID. Women would get together for like kind of like a cocktail party online.
Sure.
Which we were all trying to keep ourselves sane.
Yeah.
So I totally get it. But that drinking has really not abated, and in fact is increasing. There was a focus story in CBS News today. We're going to talk about that at 5:10. Also, what about the uneven history of electing our judges? You know, we've done it in Western Pennsylvania for so long. It's almost like we don't think about it. But then when you stop to think about it.
What are we doing that for?
I can see that that's a good thing. I can also see that's a very bad thing.
Yeah. Bruce Ankowiak is with us from Grove City College. He'll talk about that, where he's a law professor. Judges and the integrity of electing them. What's that all about?
Also, in the 4 o'clock hour, The Ultimate Guide to Pittsburgh in the Spring, which was mm-hmm. published today by Next Pittsburgh. They did a great job with that, so we'll discuss it. Also, two features, Does This Make Sense? And also, It's a Day for 5 at 5.
Very good. Mm-hmm. Okay, all that and more.
Today, I'm giving a 5 at 5 to producer Lexi Merritt.
Very nice. Okay, good.
Get yourself ready, Lex.
Get your pen ready to go.
I don't really know what you can do to prepare, but...
Not much.
I'll do my best.
I mean, after yesterday's grilled cheese extravaganza, it's hard to top. All right. So let's look at the news stories of the day. Top 4 at 4. Kath, please.
It's Thursday, March 21st, 2024. Number 1.
All right.
In an exclusive today, John, the Wall Street Journal has detailed a grim pattern of atrocities in the Darfur region of Sudan, perpetrated by mostly Arab fighters against black indigenous communities over the past 11 months. It's a continuation of the mass killings 20 years ago that prompted worldwide protests. You might remember the high visibility outrage of celebrities. I think Clooney was involved with that. It was a big situation. Unfortunately, not as much attention now, but those hostilities are being revived amid a broader war for control over Sudan, which is Africa's third largest country. And the fight is between two of the most powerful generals.
Yikes.
That's what's going on. But what's happening to the average person in this region is so shocking, John. Diplomatic efforts by the U.S. and other powers to end the fighting and protect civilians have fallen behind bigger foreign policy priorities like Ukraine, like Gaza. But this report in the journal details appalling acts of violence and cruelty, which the U.N. says have led to the deaths of tens of thousands of Darfuris and the forced displacement of 3 million people, which is a fourth of the territory's estimated population.
Holy smokes.
I mean, it's a really difficult read, but I think it's an important one. It's in today's Wall Street Journal. Number two, for the first time ever, surgeons at Mass General in Boston have transplanted a pig kidney into a living human patient. It's the first successful procedure of its kind in the world. The kidney recipient is a 62-year-old man. He's recovering well and expects to be discharged soon. He was suffering from end-stage kidney disease at the time of the transplant. The United Network for Organ Sharing says more than 100,000 people in our country are waiting for a transplant. 17 people die each day while the wait is going on. This particular patient has been living with type 2 diabetes and hypertension for many years, received a kidney transplant in 2018 after 7 years of dialysis. I cannot imagine what that would be like. And about 5 years later, the kidney showed signs of failure. He said, "I saw this not only as a way to help me, but a way to provide hope for the thousands of people who need a transplant to survive."
So genetically modified to reduce rejection.
Right. That's wild. You can read more about that today's CBS News. Number three, the Justice Department in 16 states and DAs are accusing Apple of breaking federal antitrust laws in a huge lawsuit unveiled today. The civil complaint alleges the company has illegally wielded a monopoly over the smartphone market by cutting off developers and stifling competitors with punitive restrictions. European regulators fined Apple nearly $2 billion this month after they accused it of abusing its influence over music streaming platforms and preventing developers from informing users about alternative and cheaper services. You can read more about that at the Washington Post. And number four, close to home, John. Happy to tell you that the Pittsburgh Public Schools have authorized their solicitor to sue Allegheny County in order to undergo a county-wide property reassessment.
So what does that mean?
Well, it means we're going to wait to see. That's your top four at four.
Okay.
It was approved 8-0 because they're in such a big budget crisis.
Yep.
The Pittsburgh Public Schools. They've got reduced revenue. They've got decreased enrollment. They haven't done a countywide reassessment, they said, since 2012. Mm-hmm. And all of the major commercial property owners, you know, owners of some of the huge skyscrapers in downtown,
yep,
are appealing their property values.
Taking a
and
hit.
Lowering the amount of property taxes they have to pay, which is going to make, you know, that's going to downstream really hurt the Pittsburgh Public Schools budget, which
sure,
they said they cannot meet at this time.
So it's a tsunami of lawsuits,
yes,
coming our way.
Yeah, so we'll see what Sarah Inamorato has to say about that, because that's going to land on her desk.
Government suing government. All right, with that happy news, we'll take a quick break. When we do come back,
I tried
though,
to find like a happy story for the
wasn't
top
there.
Four.
Sunshine,
yeah,
that's the happy news. Your church needs your contentment. That's straight ahead. It is the Thursday edition of The Ride Home. Stay with us. Pittsburgh Christian Talk. It's Word FM.
Happy to have David Kaywood on the show for the first time, Senior Associate Pastor at Eastside Community Church in Jacksonville, Florida. John picked up an article that he wrote called "Your Church Needs Your Contentment" in the gospelcoalition.org's website. And so we're happy to have you, David. Welcome.
Glad to be on the show. Thanks for having me.
Truly our pleasure, David. So your new work, which is the Gospel Coalition piece extracted from A Call to Contentment, Pursuing Godly Satisfaction in a Restless World. You start off your article talking about Hope Evangelical Community Church. This is a case in point. I think it probably is pretty common across many thousands of churches in the United States. Tell us the story about Hope Community.
Well, I kind of talk about this church in there called Hope Evangelical Community Church. And I use a fictitious example, but honestly, this is not just a fictitious example. It's just things that I hear about churches around the world as a pastor, as pastor friends. And essentially, this is kind of a church that it's been around for 50 plus years, and it's not growing, and they're not seeing conversions and people come to Christ and grow in Christ. And what people don't realize is it's not growing because of the people in there. And sometimes what poses the threat to a church growth or seeing a vibrant, healthy church are church members who are in one place for a long time, and they become entitled. And they say, "This is my church. I've been here for 50 years. My grandpa was at this church, and we fought for it for the battles." And in there, the good that they've done, which is staying there and fighting for the church, they've become entitled and they've become quite discontent and not open to new changes from pastoral staff. Mm. So the idea of the article was just to spur people to recognize that you need to be content to be a good church member.
Yeah, and that's a tough situation for a pastor who, you know, might be called into a church body that's filled with a handful of people who've maybe been there their whole lives, or maybe their dad was the former pastor, or maybe their grandpa was the head of session at one point. So they have a lot more time invested in the church. But the pastor is coming in to, you know, maybe, well, to lead the church, but maybe to mix things up or maybe to offer. And I can see that that could be a real point of dissension between those two parties.
Yeah, it is. And being a pastor is hard, and it takes a lot of patience and a lot of love for people, and nothing replaces time and the presence of sheep. And sheep, all of us, including me, you know, naturally, we're just sort of distrusting and we're skeptical of people. And whenever we have something new, like a new pastor, it can create a sense of anxiety. It's just a hard situation. It's hard for the pastor and his family to come into an established church that needs to be revitalized and needs to grow. And it's hard for the church members who have been there for a long time trying to receive the pastor. But in it all, through the power of the gospel and through personal godliness, if both parties, the pastor and the church, are content in Jesus and they're not looking for, you know, this is my ministry, or they don't feel threatened by others, or they don't feel a sense of territorialism about what they're serving in the serving area, they can come to a healthy partnership and see the church become effective.
Mm-hmm. David, oftentimes when I think about contentment, I think about this quote. I mean, I've memorized this quote years ago about contentment. This is from Shakespeare's King John. It's very simple. It just goes like this. My crown is in my heart, not on my head. A crown it is that seldom kings wear. It is decked not with diamonds or Indian stones. My crown is called content. And so when I think about contentment, we live in a discontented society, always sort of comparing ourselves to each other, always moaning, complaining. We have lost the love of contentment, and especially within the church, haven't we?
We really have. And I talk about this in my brand new book, A Call to Contentment, which is out now, about how we now have all this material and economic prosperity that our ancestors never enjoyed.
Yeah.
And really this sort of changed in the past 100, 200 years, whereas the life expectancy around 200 years ago was in your 40s. Now it's upper 70s, low 80s. All the technological advances and medical things that have gotten a lot better, money, wealth, opportunities for fame. 100, 200 years ago, people could have never imagined living in a world like this. And we thought it would be a blessing, and it has been a blessing in many respects. But as when you're comfortable and life can be easy, you don't really see your need for God. Mm-hmm. And this is why Christianity flourishes in countries that are not doing well, and prosperous countries, Christianity can tend to struggle. So when you are not satisfied in God and you look for satisfaction in worldly accomplishments, success, validation, money, a second home, it just leads to all kinds of issues. And I talk about how discontentment really is the root sin of all kinds of other sins. And if you can just kill discontentment in your life and get to this place where you're satisfied in Jesus, you can be such a blessing, not only to your church, but also to your society.
Yeah. So I guess the $64,000 question is, how do you nurture contentment in your own life?
Well, I don't know where the number 64,000 came from, but I'll take it. The big question, it's something that God has to do, and it's something that you do as well. So part of it is supernatural, a supernatural presence and sense of God that He has to do on His timing. But part of it is also on you. Right. And so part of this, what I talk about in the book, is practicing the spiritual disciplines, especially unhurried Bible reading and prayer. Those are crucial. Furthermore, this practicing Thanksgiving, you know, someone asked me, you know, you wrote a book on contentment. What have you learned in your own personal life? I came to this conclusion that ingratitude is a bigger sin than I think most of us realize. And really just getting to a place in our hearts where we're constantly expressing thanks and gratitude for all that God has and will is doing in our lives. Further, just thinking about this gospel that we are sinners who deserve the wrath of God in hell, and yet because of Jesus, we're getting forgiveness and life everlasting with Christ. Just really getting to the place in our lives where we recognize what we truly deserve is God's wrath, and what we're getting is God's grace. And as a result of the gospel and what God has done for us in Christ, there should be a sense of thanksgiving and contentment for Jesus and what he's done for us. I talk about other practical things in there as well, like taking care of your body as best as you can with sleep, exercise, and nutrition, and just guarding your heart, you know, with social media and Netflix and news. You don't really need to be consuming more than what you need for your life. Just practical opportunities to guard your heart and watch what you consume are just various ways that you can pursue contentment.
That's David Kaywood. He's the author of the new book, Your Church Needs Your... Nope, the new book is called A Call to Contentment, Pursuing Godly Satisfaction in a Restless World. But you can read an excerpt from it in the Gospel Coalition, The Church Needs Your Contentment. I just want to go into this fictitious story that you set up at the beginning of this, just to kind of close our conversation out. You talk about a fictitious church that started with a top-down approach in leadership. So you had a pastor that was kind of in charge of stuff, and then there was a bunch of committees. New pastor comes in and says, hey, what about the idea of elders? And he presents his case for having elders, and the leaders of the church are impressed, and they think it's all looking good. But then one person disrupts the plan. And she starts saying, look, the church has been doing fine since I was baptized here as a baby. We don't need to change our church government. My college ministry didn't need elders, and neither does this church. And she wasn't a horrible person. She wasn't a gossip. You say she wasn't a person who you would think would put a wrecking ball to an idea. She was a very compassionate, committed person in the church. But the long and the short of it is that the idea of elders ended up not passing. So I just wanted to lay that story out so that you can tell our listeners the kind of practical things that contentment or uncontentment looks like in maybe a personal community church.
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the ironies of that quote is that my college ministry didn't have elders, neither does the church, is that college ministry literally never have elders anywhere.
Right,
they're not local churches. So, in this example, this person is that the discontentment. You really have to be humble and acknowledge: am I the problem here? Am I causing an issue? Do I find too much of my identity in serving? And so, when we're discontent, a negative fruit of discontentment in the church is that we're not able to disagree without being divisive. I think this is a huge in 2024 with an election season, the message of contentment, because our hearts are going to be on social media and the news, and then we're going to bring this into the church, and we're not going to be able to disagree without being divisive. And I think that's the fruit of not necessarily resting in God's sovereignty in your church and in your life. So a big negative fruit of discontentment is that you're divisive. And you cause issues, and you whenever there's leadership, elder-led leadership is trying to do something, you feel the need to fight at all times. Certainly, please speak your mind. Certainly, push back. If there's sin, then you need to bring it up. If the church just is going in a direction you don't agree, you could quietly leave. But when you're divisive, then you're probably being very, very much in the line of discontentment. Mm-hmm. On the other side, when you're content. One of the things I've noticed in church leadership is that people who serve a lot, if they don't get recognition, they get frustrated at pastors for not giving them recognition. And I totally agree that there needs to be a spirit of encouragement in the church. But if you're constantly serving in children's ministry and youth ministry, and then you're getting frustrated because you're not getting praise and recognition, you might be serving for the wrong reasons. So why are you serving in the first place? Well, if you're content, you can serve without needing recognition or approval from others.
David, it's such an interesting idea. I mean, it's so complex, but a church without contentment, sooner or later, it kind of self-destructs, doesn't it? Because it's like a poison from within.
Absolutely.
Thanks, David. We appreciate this. I mean, it's a good heads up, a good reminder to foster contentment, humility in our own lives. The two go hand in hand. So thanks for your time here today to talk to us about this.
That's a great word to end it on. Thanks for having me on the show.
Truly our pleasure. Pastor David K. Woods, Senior Associate Pastor at Eastside Community Church. His piece, the new book, A Call to Contentment, Pursuing Godly Satisfaction in a Restless World. We'll take a quick break.
Coming up next, the annual number of objects that humans have launched into space.
Get your abacus out. If you have any interest at all in outer space and man's push into space, I mean, the rise of what's happening right now, especially with private enterprise fueling the number of spacecrafts, satellites, any number of things that are now being launched into outer space, is truly overwhelming because it feels as though this happens every day. I have an app that I follow, and it tells me, today this is what's happening, this is what's going on.
Well, back up. You have an app that tells you what's launched into space?
Yeah.
What app is that?
It's called Space Tracker. And so they're just, you know, all this is public information.
Yeah.
So they're compiling this and they're just giving you a heads up. Today, this is what's going to happen. And then you can, you know, follow through with that.
Okay.
So
I like how you're talking like all of us are tracking the amount of space junk we have.
I guess it's just, you know, it's just become so common to me.
Yeah.
Where before, I mean, I grew up in the era of the space race, the great space race. And so every launch was like a major thing. It was like, sit down, we're going to watch the Mercury astronauts go into space or the Gemini. And then finally the Apollo men landed on the moon.
Right.
Well, here's an article from Our World in Data, and it's the annual number of objects launched into space.
Okay.
And you can track along year to year to year, and worldwide the number of objects, and then what country is launching those objects.
Okay.
So in 1957, there were 8 objects launched into outer space.
In what year?
1957.
Okay, 1957.
Yep. Eight objects.
Okay.
7 of them were by the United States. 1 was by Russia.
Okay.
Now, by comparison, let me fast forward here. Let me fast forward to this new graph. In 2023, there were 2,000. I'm sorry. There were 2,664 objects launched into outer space in 1 year alone. 2,166 by the United States, 144 by the UK, 128 by China, Russia 62, Japan 11, France 10, India 9. It just goes on and on. Now, this, of course, largely pushed by who else? Elon Musk and SpaceX. Because whenever they launch spaceships, they'll send out literally at one time 200 to 300 satellites in outer space.
What? Oh.
It's called Starlink.
Okay. And what's that for?
Communications, mostly.
For that launch?
Yes.
Like for that? Okay.
Yes. No.
Oh, no.
Private enterprise.
Oh.
Launching satellites into space.
Oh, so they kind of rent along with the the trip?
Yep.
So I'll take your satellite
exactly.
If you pay me this much money?
That's where SpaceX, I mean, that's the most profitable Elon Musk enterprise.
I didn't know that.
He's making billions of dollars on this enterprise. Private enterprise launching satellites or spacecraft into space. I mean, the goal is to go to Mars. But look, 8 in 57, that was what, 65 years ago, 66 years ago, and more than almost 3,000 this past year.
So this is probably an ignorant question, but what happens to the 2,600 from last year? Are they still up there?
Pretty much, yep. Which, if you were in low orbit, I mean, that's still hundreds of miles up. There is so much clutter up there. There is so many objects that are out there. The International Space Station, of course, that's more space stuff. It regularly has to do maneuvers to avoid space junk. Up and down, sideways, back and forth.
Okay, so it's not just comparing 8 objects to 2,600 objects. It's the accumulation over all those years.
So look, if you look at like 1969, that's when man first landed on the moon. there were hundreds of objects being launched into outer space then. Because the rise of the satellites, communication satellites, and then from the late 60s to where we are now, every year, hundreds, hundreds, more hundreds, hundreds and hundreds, then finally thousands and thousands and more thousands. So I don't know what the exact number is, but easily there's 10,000 plus more objects in outer space.
So this is kind of like Mount Everest.
Exactly.
Right? Which has just been, the peak of it has been completely wrecked by oxygen tanks and
minutia
and you name it.
Great explorers, you know, all that exploration, it comes at a cost. So there's a lot of, and a lot of these things are operating as they should. A lot of them have died or are disused. That's space junk. Sooner or later, a percentage of these will fall back to Earth and burn up in the atmosphere. But some of them, many of them, will stay out there and just be space junk forever.
That's an incredible story. Wow.
Let's take a quick break. When we do come back, we're going to talk about the Festival of Homiletics. That's next in The Ride Home. We have a good friend who's a fantastic pastor and an excellent preacher. And he would regularly say, for every minute that he preaches from the pulpit, he spends more than an hour in preparation. And when you hear our friend preach, you kind of nod your head and go.
That makes sense, right?
Yeah, because he's so incredibly powerful. So what is it? What is it like to engage in the art of preaching? Because I do believe
it is an art.
Yeah, it really truly is. Well, the Festival of Homiletics is coming to Pittsburgh, and Dr. Caroline Lewis joins us. She's professor and chair of biblical preaching, Lutheran Seminary, St. Paul, Minnesota, program director of the Festival of Homiletics. And Caroline, welcome to the show.
I am delighted to be here. Thanks so much.
Caroline, when I think of, I've been going to church my whole life. I've heard a lot of sermons. I've seen a lot of pastors. I think those of us who sit in the pews don't realize what it takes to do that. I mean, you know, you go every week and say, so okay, here comes the sermon. Like anybody could just get up and throw some ideas together and
I'm riffing.
Right, and make it stick. So your view on that, Carolyn, do you agree that most people in the pews just don't even have a clue?
Oh, I think that's absolutely right, that we show up on Sunday morning and the Holy Spirit just kind of drops from the sky and inspires us to say something that's somewhat intelligent and somewhat meaningful. But you're right. It takes a lot of work to prepare and preach a solid, faithful sermon. Mm-hmm. And that really is what you spend a lot of your time doing during the week if you're in pastoral ministry.
I bet. Yeah. The rigor and the discipline, the intellectual and spiritual heft to produce that week in and week out. So the Festival of Homiletics coming into Pittsburgh, where we're really curious about this, excited this is going to happen. Talk about this, Caroline. What will this look like?
Well, we are super excited to be coming to Pittsburgh. It is a new city for us. We've been in Denver and Atlanta and San Antonio and Minneapolis, and this is a new city. So we're very excited. What this looks like is about 1,000 preachers descending upon Pittsburgh.
That's cool.
And we have two primary churches that are hosting us along with Pittsburgh Seminary. And we have preachers from all over the country and even the world coming to these venues, coming to Pittsburgh to preach, to do lectures, to do workshops, and to worship together.
Fabulous.
And so we all gather together and we listen to these sermons and we get inspired and we learn new things about the craft. And it is really an inspiring time to be together. You kind of you realize that you're not alone in this process. And so you come away just feeling encouraged and about what you do and the craft of preaching. Mm.
I'm sure that living as a pastor, you get used to most people in your orbit not really getting what you do, you know, or not getting what it takes to do what you do, or the kind of preparation or reading or study or, you know, performance, you know, practice you have to do. So getting in a room with other, and I think this because I've been a worship leader for a long time, and most people don't understand what goes into that. But when I've gone to conferences that are full of worship leaders, it's so, there's something about it that's so relaxing because you feel like I don't have to explain anything to anybody. Like they all know what goes into this. And so we can kind of skip the preliminaries and just get into like talking about, oh, how do you do it? Or how do I do it?
That's exactly right. And when we gather together for the Festival of Homiletics, one of the things that is so, as you said, relaxing and so comforting is that you're going there and you know you don't have to preach any of those sermons.
Yeah.
You have done no work to get there, and you can just let that sermon, you can just experience it and let it preach to you. And so it's really this amazing experience of just, yeah, I don't have to do anything. And the other thing about it too is that while we tend to kind of get in that critique mode, what would I have done? What, you know, how would I have done differently? The spirit there is so much about being fed. And so it creates these conversations outside of the event itself where you really are uplifting each other and talking to each other, as you said, talking to each other in a different kind of way that's not about competition or uncertainty or kind of imposter syndrome,
yeah.
But it's just wanting to be with other preachers and learning from each other.
That's so good. So, Caroline, I think about this, Caroline. You know, we live in this, you know, for better or worse, the golden age of streaming, where at our fingertips, we have access to hundreds of thousands of, you know, movies and all kind of series and whatnot. So all of us, you know, whether we intended to or not, we've become so steeped in this in a casual way. And we've also become critics, right? So everyone is viewing, everyone's watching, everybody has an opinion. And I wonder about the pastors, what it's like for them now to be, you know, in this arena where, you know, years ago we weren't surrounded by this, and especially in the seminaries, seminary awareness about this new era that we live in and teaching pastors. I mean, is this a thing? I guess that's my ask. Is this a thing where now seminaries have to respond to this to sharpen the skill of a, you know, maybe a not a naturally gifted preacher and teacher to sort of rise it up so everyone's not sitting there going, I've got this guy's number. I'm bored by this. I'm checking out. This is not, you know, applicable to me. I want to go to a different church. Is that a thing?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's a thing. And it's one of the great pivots, right, of the pandemic, of course, where with seminary education, we had to go online. So we were all trying to learn how to teach online and then learn how to teach preaching online.
Yeah, yeah.
So there were a lot of pivots and a lot of learning that had to happen in that regard. Mm. And so we are really bringing a new kind of skill set to the teaching of preaching of how is it that, particularly, how is it that you do or pay attention to an embodied reality, even though you're on a screen, which is so important for connection and for authenticity and for people really engaging you. How do you do that when you're just staring at a screen? And so what we've really had to think a lot about and talk a lot about with our students is trusting that their congregation does want to listen to them, that mm-hmm. comes from that relationship that they've built over the years. Because it's easy to think, oh, yeah, they could go anywhere. They could, you know, they could listen to any fabulous preacher, watch any fabulous preacher, but they come to listen to you because they know you and they have a relationship with you and you are saying something to them because you know them and you have a relationship with them. So that's what we've really had to focus on, that and to believe that, so that you don't get this sense of they're not going to come back.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
Let me tell our listeners who we're talking to here. First of all, we're talking about the Festival of Homiletics, which is coming to Pittsburgh. We're talking to the Reverend Dr. Caroline Lewis, who's professor and chair of biblical preaching at Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota. She's also the program director of this festival. Caroline, I guess I want to ask you something that we didn't talk about at first, which is, why did you decide you wanted to do this? And I don't mean run the festival. I mean, like, become a preacher.
Well, it's one of those stories that I'm afraid is kind of typical, but I'll tell it anyway.
Sure, good.
I I was raised as a PK, a preacher's kid.
There it is.
And when you are raised as a preacher's kid, you then swear you will never bear.
Right.
Of course.
Well, and then here I am.
Yeah.
So
surprise.
I had a kind of circuitous route, but I was raised in it. And I believe in the power of words and rhetoric. And I believe that God is at work in the world and that people need to hear that good news. And so eventually I was drawn to that. I was also a violin performance major in my former life. And there's something about preaching that captures that performance, that you're interpreting a text. I love interpreting texts. I love reading text, you know, scripture and seeing what I'm going to discover. But then there's something about putting it into a form that's going to be proclaimed that is really exciting for me. And it makes a difference in people's lives. And
okay.
I think that's
Caroline, let me interrupt you though, because I'm sure there are some people listening who are horrified by the thought that performance could be linked with preaching.
It has to be hand in hand.
I think it has to be. I mean, John is a former actor, so he gets that. I'm a worship leader.
Yeah.
I get that. But I'm sure a lot of people don't think that it's, talk about how performance and preaching go hand in hand.
Absolutely. Well, performance, I think, has what ends up happening is that it has a negative connotation, typically, when it comes to preaching, that performance is entertainment or performance is persuasion. And that's really not, as you two know, that's not it at all. To what extent the performance really means to bring to its goal, I mean, to bring to, you know, to perform, to bring into its intended form. And so a sermon really isn't a sermon until it's preached. Until it's performed. And it's not just, it's helping preachers think about the fact that it's not just what they say, but how they say it is communicating meaning. And so how do you wed those two of the content of the sermon, but how you deliver it, the words you choose, your vocal variation, all of that makes a difference for the meaning of the sermon.
That's good. You're preaching to the choir, Caroline.
Yeah,
we got that.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay, so talk about the nuts and bolts of the festival itself. This is not for the general public, but it is for preachers. What about the dates and all the other things that we should know about?
Right. So the dates are, we're coming up here pretty soon, right? So we arrive on the 13th of May and go through the 16th of May. So it's a 4-day conference. We begin Monday night with a worship together and a preacher and a sermon. And then Tuesday, Wednesday are full days, packed days full of preachers, sermons, lectures, workshops. We do also have some social events in the evening. But one of the things that we're focusing on this year, we always have a theme, and the theme is nurturing and sustaining the preaching life. And so we've added some opportunities for yoga and taizé and meditation and some art to get preachers to think about how do they sustain and nurture this craft and this life, this preaching life to which we are dedicated. And so, and when we end on Thursday with a final worship service and off people go. And so that's where we'll be. But you can just drop in. Anybody can just drop in if you want to hear some good preaching and some wonderful worship and some great lectures.
Well, great. So then I stand corrected. It is for everybody then.
Yeah, you can drop in anytime you want.
Fabulous. What about website information for more deeper dive?
Yes. So the site is festivalofhomiletics.org, and you go right there. And what you will see is the schedule. You'll see all of our speakers who will be presenting, and also a little bit about our venues, the two churches that are hosting us, as well as the seminary, and really all of the nuts and bolts that you would need to be able to attend the festival. We also have vendors and sponsors, so you can even do a little shopping if you want.
Very good.
That's the Reverend Dr. Caroline Lewis, Professor and Chair of Biblical Preaching at Luther Seminary, St. Paul, Minnesota. Caroline, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, and we'll see you in Pittsburgh.
Yes, look forward to it. Really interesting stuff. We'll take a quick break. We're going to come back. The ultimate guide to Pittsburgh in the spring.
I'm doing something this weekend.
It's here.
It's
you know
here,
it's here.
And I am geeked.
Two days ago, spring finally arrived. It was a very easy winter for us, right?
We have nothing to complain about.
Nope. But our friends at Next Pittsburgh have provided us with a bucket list of quintessential Pittsburgh spring things to do. Now, you do this every year. The first one, you go to the Pittsburgh Botanic Gardens at Phipps.
Doing it this weekend.
Excellent.
Yes. You cannot miss the flower show at Phipps. If you've never been, you're missing out.
So lovely.
It's so beautiful. It's such a great... I don't know. It's just hopeful, encouraging, beautiful. It's everything good.
And it runs only through April 14th.
Yeah, so you got to get there and make a plan.
Cherry Blossom Bike Ride. We may not have many cherry blossoms in D.C., but springtime in Pittsburgh is filled with cherry blossoms. Mm-hmm. Head to the North Shore and bike along the water to see them. Peak time for cherry blossoms is now through the first week of April. You can stop for an outdoor lunch as well if the weather's cooperating.
Okay.
Of course, always riding the incline is one of those spring bucket lists because it's fairly warm there, as long as the inclines are operating.
The last time we rode the incline, it was about 3 degrees.
Oh, my gosh.
That was...
There was ice on the windows. I mean, seriously.
There was ice on my face.
Of course, the Friday fish fry, perfect for spring, right? Next Pittsburgh has a list of, of the thousands, literally thousands of fish fries. We love ourselves a fish fry here, right? Pirate game. Yes, we do. Opening day for the Bucks is April the 5th. I'll be there.
Great.
And hope that you go find yourself a seat at PNC Park and enjoy a pirate game. Picnic along the Allegheny River Trail Park. Have you been to the Allegheny River Trail lately? Renovations at the public park in Aspinwall are finished. The space is more peaceful than ever. A fenced-in dog park, biking and walking trails, plenty of chairs. The front yard project has expanded the park by 6 acres. Now includes space for food truck parking, hammocks, additional child play areas. You can also take a bookstore tour through Bloomfield, which is surprising to me. Aside from going to trivia at Two Phrase Brewery or visiting Spack Brothers for pizza... they're going to have a book tour.
You're saying in Bloomfield?
Yes.
Okay, so White Whale Books is White in Bloomfield.
Big Idea Bookstore and Cafe and Few of a Kind.
So
that's three different bookstores in Bloomfield.
I don't know the other two.
I don't either. I've been to White Whales.
Right.
It's a fine bookstore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you could also go to Pizza Italia if you're there.
Oh, of course you can.
Which is right in Liberty Avenue, and I'd recommend that you go there.
And coming up is the Three Rivers Comic Con, which is not necessarily springtime, but it's early summer.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. For those who are so inclined. Very nice.
One of my favorite things is walking into the Orchid Room. Everybody has a different room.
At Phipps.
If you are a member at Phipps or if you go regularly, you might be like me and you develop a favorite.
Sure.
Right. There is nothing that smells as delightful as when you walk into the Orchid Room. It just washes over you.
Phipps Conservatory. Mm-hmm.
Welcome to another edition of The Ride Home with John and Kathy, live from the Salem-Pittsburgh studios. And now here are your hosts, John Hall and Kathy Emmons.
A very happy Thursday afternoon to you. Very happy in many ways. The sun is shining, which is always a major benefit here across western Pennsylvania.
Yep.
And it is a Thursday. It feels as though, we talked about this, a long, long week.
It does. But, today the Duquesne Dukes played in March Madness for the first time in 40-some years.
Do you know what happened?
No, I'm not looking.
Good.
So I'm sure all of you out there are hearing this. And
don't say anything.
Don't say anything.
Email,
if there's people,
no,
I don't want to know.
No,
don't call
calls.
Lexi and tell her what happened.
Hey, Lex.
Because we are blissfully ignorant, and we'll watch when we get home.
We filled out a bracket, though.
Yes, and I feel very positively about mine.
Mm-hmm. I know so little. It's just me kind of
That's fine.
Yeah.
Because knowing something doesn't help.
No, I think so.
Right. So this is a thing where you just celebrate ignorance.
Right. And I have no money in the game.
Right.
Not betting a nickel.
Right.
Well, right.
No. There's a wager on the line.
Oh, that's right. Well, then not
Lexi,
money.
Lexi, would
not
you
money.
Discuss the wager, please?
Yeah, of course. I said that the first one out saying, like, every bracket that you've build has lost, basically, in our three trio bracket. If you are the first out, you have to bake cookies for the office, which is not a hard ask because there's
really
not many
isn't.
People here.
Look at John's face. Look, he's so appalled.
He's so upset.
I hope I don't do that. I hope I do really good.
Yeah.
If it makes you feel any better, I'm pretty sure I will be the first one.
No,
out.
Never, I'll
you
be
never
the first
know.
One
you
out.
Never know,
come
right?
On.
I mean, we're all just like neophytes.
Right,
here.
Right.
It's the clueless trio.
So there's a lot on the line, my friend.
Right.
You know what's waiting there for you is butter, sugar, and a hand mixer.
You know what's waiting for you? A burnt cookie. Just saying.
All right. Coming up this hour, what about electing justices? I mean, we have done that in Western Pennsylvania, obviously for my whole life. I never stopped to think about the pluses and minuses of that and how in different parts of the country, judges are appointed.
Yeah.
They're not elected.
It seems a little shaky, to be honest.
It does. So we're going to talk to Bruce Yankoviak, who's become a good friend of ours, law professor at St. Vincent College, around 5:35. Also, we'll talk about the world's deepest hotel, which will be interesting. And in just a little while, more women drinking themselves sick and what that means for the way that we deal with alcohol. But before that, John,
yes.
I do believe it's time for 5 at 5.
Oh, very nice. It's a fairly new feature here, right?
I like it. I like to stretch beforehand so I can perform at my best.
So there is a giver and a receiver, right?
It's like the $25,000 pyramid.
Right. Five things under a category. Yesterday, earlier in the week, we did sandwiches.
Yes.
Right?
Right. You gave and I received.
Right. I gave you what?
You gave me
Old
grilled
Testament.
Cheese. Oh, Old Testament figures.
Yes.
Yeah, that was pretty tough. And I started to read Nehemiah.
Because of that.
Yeah,
see,
because I was
reason.
Like, I put Nehemiah at number five, and now I
felt bad about it.
I did.
God's in the works.
Today, I'm the giver, and Lexi Merritt, our producer, is the receiver.
All right. You got a pen?
Lexi, do you have a pen?
Pen, paper.
Are you ready for this?
Yes, I am.
Fallout Boy.
Oh.
Owl City. Paramore. All Time Low. My Chemical Romance.
Oh, this is hard.
Exactly. Why do you think I did it?
Okay, so you just...
see, these are pop punk bands.
Yeah. You could have been reciting Chinese.
Exactly. These are pop punk bands, which is a genre that Lexi very much likes.
Yes, I do.
And so I decided that I would stack these all up to make us as unpleasant as possible
all
for
right.
me to choose.
Take us on a tour, Lex.
If you would have given me this in, like, 2012, when all of these bands would have been in every playlist I've ever made, this would be impossible. Man, this is hard. This is a really good list of artists.
Thank you.
In general. I think number five is going to have to be My Chem.
Oh,
My
okay.
Chemical Romance.
And why is that?
They were not
no
a
Black
band
Parade for you.
Well, I love that song.
Yeah,
and I love
song.
A lot of their albums. But out of this list, it's a pretty good list. So I'm going to say My Chem is number five. Just above them at number four is Owl City.
Okay.
Which is so hard because I adore Owl City.
The one dude.
Yeah, he's a really good artist, and he's a Christian. I don't know if you knew that or not.
I did not know that.
Yes, he's a Christian, and if you listen to any of his albums with that frame in mind, it's so obvious.
Oh, right. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, so please, listen to his music with that thought in mind, and you'll adore him. But he'll be number four. I think number three has to be Fall Out Boy. I have seen Fall Out Boy live. They put on a decent show.
I've seen him live.
But I would not put them above number two, which is Paramore.
Oh!
Who I have not seen live, but I adore Hayley Williams with all my being.
Yes.
And number one has to be the band that I've seen the most times in concert, All Time Low. Just recently saw them this past year. And they put on an amazing show. So that is my 5 at 5.
Outstanding.
Yeah.
All right. Check out any of these bands, would you, listeners?
All right. We'll take a quick break. Come back. Not exactly a happy story ahead, right?
No, it's not a happy story, but it's a story we need to talk about.
All right. We're talking about the rise of women and drinking. Stick around for that. I got sober in August of 1987, kind of by accident, quite honestly, although that's not really true, because when I say I was out of my mind, I was out of my mind. I was not in the right thinking mode. And I had lost my my day planner, my day timer, in a cab. And some kind person in Manhattan found my day timer and somehow rummaged through it and found my phone number and called my service.
Wow.
And said, this is my address. Come pick it up. So I went down to the Lower East Side and I bought some flowers at a little Korean sort of bodega and bought some flowers as a thank you. Walked off the side street, and there was a little sign on this brownstone that I was walking by that said, the mustard seed. And I was like, oh, that looks interesting. Wonder what that's all about. Anyway, went to the place, said hello to the person who found my day timer, many thanks, got it back, gave the flowers, and then walked back the same way I came, where again I saw the sign, the mustard seed. And I thought, I'm going to go in there.
Did you know what it was?
Nope. So it was a basement. The mustard seed was in the basement of a brownstone. And I walked in, and it was a low ceiling of a very dark, and I would dare to say, a bit of a stinky room. It was summer in New York City, so there was a mix of coffee and BO.
And a little exhaust seeping.
And it was wild. I had never witnessed anything like it in my life.
What was it?
Two separate rooms, a front room and a back room. It was all folding chairs, and it was an AA meeting.
And you had no idea that's what it was when you walked in?
No. And I walked in, and I sat down, and within literally 6 minutes, they had me. I mean, the things that I heard, the stories that were told, the people that were there, and I went in that room, and I stayed in that room for years. I say all this because in that time frame and in that room, it was largely, no exaggeration, easily 90% guys. And it was a mix. It was Bowery bums and Wall Street guys. So you could be sitting next to a guy wearing a $5,000 suit or sitting next to some guy who had gone in his pants an hour earlier. It was that disparate. But it was primarily men. But since that time, I've used that model of guys in rooms to keep me sober. And it hasn't been maybe the last 15 years that I've seen more so a rise of women in the rooms than I ever have before. Now I would say it's parity. It's pretty much 50-50.
50-50.
Yeah.
Do you know what or to what you attribute the change?
Well, the times have changed, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know the statistics on this, but just as though pornography was once male-dominated, I think it's also an equal opportunity offender as well. So there is so much sin that's easily available that it has, and the barriers have lowered, right? There was a time when you would say, I'm an alcoholic. It would come with a measure of despair and shame that you would not talk about that openly. But now I think it's pretty much a common thing. People who are in recovery, it's not only celebrated, of course, but it's encouraged. It's a necessary component of what it is to be alive in 21st century America. So the barriers have fallen.
In 2023, one estimate predicted that women would end up accounting for close to half of alcohol-associated liver disease. Close to half. And it's a high priority topic for the Biden administration, also for the Department of Health and Human Services. Rachel Seiko Adams, reading here from CBS News, works at Boston University School of Public Health. And she says it's a touchy topic.
It's touchy. Why?
She said, because when it comes to medically examining alcohol use, there's just no safe level. And she said it's new information that people don't want to know. So this is what she goes on to say. Over the past 50 years, women have increasingly entered the workforce and they've delayed motherhood, and parenthood has historically been a protective factor when it comes to alcohol use. It doesn't mean that people who have kids aren't addicted to alcohol, but fewer people who are parents are addicted to alcohol than people that don't have kids.
Makes sense.
Right, because you have this sense of
responsibility.
I'm responsible for these kids, right? But more than 600,000 people in the U.S. died from causes related to alcohol between 1999 and 2020. But the reason that this came into my head is because I noticed this starting for women during the COVID pandemic. This article says that those months and years significantly exacerbated binge drinking for women. Women more than men use alcohol to cope with stress.
Makes sense.
So a lot of men drink alcohol for different reasons, but when it comes to coping, that's why women do it.
So it's just management.
Right. It's just management. Mm-hmm. Women are also frequently, CBS goes on to say, I think this is not CBS. I think I'm saying CBS, but I mean the Washington Post. Nope. It's CBS. It goes on to say that women are frequently the focus of gender-targeted advertising for alcohol. This has happened since the COVID pandemic. Rosé sales, low-calorie wines have exploded in recent years. They're calling it the pinking of products that have alcohol in them. You can see all sorts of alcoholic canned beverages that are targeted for women.
Sure.
Like all the fruity things, right?
Right. Spritzers and whatnot.
Right. Also at play is the emergence of a phenomenon, reading here from CBS, largely perpetuated by women on social media that makes light of drinking to deal with the difficulties of motherhood. Mm-hmm. This is how it came to me, not the drinking, thank goodness, but this idea of it over COVID, because I saw people talking about mommy wine culture.
Right. Right. It's a thing.
So if you drink in a normal way, in a moderate way, that's just how you have to deal with how terrible motherhood is. And if you can handle alcohol, you're fine. It's no big deal. You can just keep on doing it. This came up with my friends. This came up with my associates. This came up with people over COVID all the time. And the longer COVID went on, the more of it I saw. Mm-hmm. And so now that we're in the post-pandemic era, I think a lot of these people who started those habits have continued those habits. And so now we've got women who have serious drinking habits. Women without children at the age of 35 are at the highest risk for binge drinking right now in America. 35 years old, without children, highest risk for binge drinking and alcohol use disorder.
Well, you see, just see it in the culture. I was walking by a strip mall the other day, and apparently there was a state store there, and the sign said, closed Easter Sunday. Which, you know, the state store system is now open 7 days a week, where before it wasn't.
Right.
So there's, you know, an availability. Of course, they sell wine in Giant Eagle or whatever.
Right.
We're just surrounded
by
this, right?
We are. And there is that type of encouragement that comes from someone saying, isn't this job hard?
Right. And you say, deserve...
I need to blow off some steam.
Right.
Right.
And everybody gets it.
Everybody gets it.
Who doesn't want to blow off steam whenever they can?
Right.
But at what cost and how often?
Dr. Stephanie Garabino is cited in this article from the Duke Health Center. And she said, often women don't know there's anything wrong with what they're doing. She says that she sees younger patients with liver disease, including women in their 20s.
What do you mean they don't know what they're doing?
They don't realize that there's anything wrong with what they're doing. They think that if there's something wrong with their alcohol use, it might be because it's affecting their work or affecting their sleep, but they don't know it's affecting their health.
Listen, if you wake up with a hangover on multiple occasions and or have blackouts, that's the warning sign that you're out of control.
You're right. Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's pretty easy to just kind of go, maybe I got a problem here.
Yeah.
And it's not about comparing yourself to anybody else, because alcoholism is really infectious. It's super sneaky. It comes upon you slowly.
Why do you say it's super sneaky?
Because you're just drinking to have fun. And then I'll drink some more. And then, my friends aren't available. Well, I'll just sit here and have a drink by myself. I'll do it again. And again, where once in a while becomes occasionally becomes more often than not, becomes every day. So much so that you need it to get through the day. So much so that when it's 3 o'clock and you think, 2 more hours, I'm going to open up that bottle. and it becomes a thirst, no pun intended. It becomes something that dominates your waking hours until you hold that glass in your hand. No shame here.
Right.
This is how the world operates. And look, Noah got drunk. Everybody.
And look what happened.
Right. Alcohol is fine in its place. But if you need help, if you feel like you're out of control, there are many, many places now that can help you through this time to get sober and to stay sober.
This article, John, started out with the story of a woman named Carla Adkins. She was 36 at the time. It was 10 years ago. She said she remembers the day she looked in the rearview mirror of her car. She was ready to pull out of a parking space, and she noticed that the whites of her eyes had turned yellow. She was working as a physician liaison for a hospital system. She had a lot of friends who were doctors and nurses, but she had struggled with heavy drinking for a long time since she was in college. But she was doing it because she was so stressed at work. She was operating at such a high level in the medical community that she didn't have a way to come down off of that high, you know what I mean, at work,
yeah,
to deal with it. And so she started drinking. So she knew when she saw that her eyes were yellow, that it was the yellow, that it was the evidence of jaundice. But she was afraid to go to the doctor, not because they would tell her that there was something wrong with her liver. She said, honestly, my number one fear was someone telling me I could never drink again.
Yeah, I get that. And that's a death sentence for an alcoholic. You don't want to hear that. How about the story the other day, the airline pilot? Did you see that story?
No, tell me.
Some guy, I forget what major airline it was, but it was a major airline. He tried to board the flight with two bottles of Jägermeister. He had drunk half a bottle of Jägermeister. He was more than three times the legal limit. This was in Scotland. He's serving a 10-month prison sentence in Scotland before he goes to the authorities and, you know, finds his way through the legal system here in the United States. Of course, his pilot's license was taken away. Who knows if we'll ever get that license back again? But talk about somebody ruining their life.
Oh, my gosh. And almost ruining the lives of 300 other people.
It's insidious.
It is insidious. Now, let me just close with a happy story, which is that within 48 hours, Carla Adkins had liver failure. And she said it was super fast. She almost died. But the good news is it was 10 years ago. And she said she's now a coach and she helps mostly women stop drinking. And she said that she's published a book. She lives with cirrhosis, but it'll be 10 years since her last drink. Hmm. She said, the amazing thing is you can't get much worse from where I got. So I'm trying to change the narrative.
So the prayer is, God, give me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen.
Does this make sense?
Does what make sense?
Ranch dressing. It's everywhere. It is everywhere.
Really? Well,
I mean, it's a topping for pizza. It's obviously a topping for salad, but people put it on salads. People dip, you know, vegetables in it.
Yeah. The only time I use ranch dressing is when I'm at Chick-fil-A.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
If I have chicken nuggets, I'm doing the ranch dip.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
The rest of the time, I would never put ranch on my salad. Never.
Mm-hmm. And why is that?
It just seems kind of funky. I'm doing like, you know, oil and vinegar or Italian, maybe. Mm-hmm. But ranch, I don't know. It's kind of viscousy, thick.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of clogs up my lettuce.
Right. Not to mention your arteries.
Yeah.
Right. So you're saying it doesn't make sense
to me. No.
No.
Does it make sense to you?
You know, it really doesn't.
What?
The viscousy thing, I think that's applicable.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's well said. It's just a lot. It's heavy, right?
How about Roquefort dressing?
No.
Even worse?
Nope. Nope.
Right?
Nope. Nope. I don't want that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, what I'd like is some good greens with a nice vinaigrette.
Yeah. Something simple.
So it doesn't make any sense. However, as a dip, it's not bad.
Okay. So thumbs down to the ranch.
Yeah. It doesn't make sense.
Unless you're Chick-fil-A.
Or for dipping. And that kind of does.
All right. Well, I'll see a ranch.
Mm-hmm.
I've been thinking about this. You know how things get stuck in your head. Does this make sense? Lemon Pledge. Remember the Lemon Pledge song? Remember that?
I don't think I do.
Lemon Pledge, very pretty. Boo, 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 doo, doo, doo. And then there's some lady, you know,
wearing
spraying
a dress.
Her dining room table.
And heels.
Yep. Right. With a little, you know, cloth. And,
right.
And boy, that looks so pretty.
Right.
I don't think in my life I've ever owned Lemon Pledge.
Oh.
I mean, I dust. I like to dust, but yeah. I don't use end dust.
Right.
And I don't use like a wax cleaner. I just. So. Lemon Pledge?
It's the smell of my childhood.
Oh, it is.
I mean, there was never a time when there weren't at least three
really?
Spray bottles of Lemon Pledge
with
around.
A little yellow top.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Lemon
and
Pledge.
An accompanying handy wipe uh-huh. next to it.
You and Nan.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. I was all about it. My mother, big time Lemon Pledge. My mom's so outstanding. That doesn't make sense.
Don't do it.
I don't think we need that. No. Why do we need to spray stuff on your furniture to get
the
dust
off?
That's
my point. Yeah.
I can smell it right now. I can kind of taste it mm-hmm. in the back of my throat.
Yeah. Maybe like, you know, like a little Christmas tree for your car, a Lemon Pledge Christmas tree.
No, we don't want that either.
It might be okay.
I don't really think so.
That doesn't make sense. The state of Pennsylvania does many odd and archaic things.
Yes.
It's the truth, right? It's a big state, and sometimes you think, what year is this? So what about the idea of electing our judges, right? Justice elected the uneven history and ethical questions of electing Pennsylvania judges. Bruce Enkobiak is back with us. He's a law professor at St. Vincent College, and he always opines on many interesting things. Bruce, this is a fascinating subject. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It really is a fascinating subject. And, you know, in the history of Pennsylvania, we always have not done this. There was a considerable period of time when judges were appointed, but as late as 1969, there was an effort made to go to the appointment system, and the voters rejected that.
Really?
So apparently, at least as of 1969, we were all happy electing judges from the district justice level all the way up through the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania.
Huh.
Okay, so tell us the benefits of elected judges. Like, give us the pro side, and then tell us the drawbacks.
Well, the pro sides are, I guess, whatever generic benefit you could derive simply from having a popular election for any office that the people get to judge. But see, the problems come in that any election, anyone that you vote for, what do you want to know? You want to know that they're basically a good person, but you want to know what they stand for. You want to know what their positions are on controversial matters. In a judicial election, a person running for judge is told by the rules of ethics of Pennsylvania, you are not allowed to announce your views on contested issues of public policy. You can't do that, because if you do that during a campaign, you are necessarily biasing yourself in a case that comes before you.
Hmm.
You could come out in the campaign and say, I believe that all drunk drivers should go to jail. Well, you can say that, and you will never be allowed to hear a drunk driving case if you get elected to the court. And in fact, you probably won't get elected because the Judicial Conduct Board will sanction you for saying that. Hmm. This is the one thing that makes a judicial election, first of all, quite an odd duck, because the candidates are not allowed to speak to the issues. That's one big drawback of it. And so what happens is, of course, political action committees speak for them. Political action committees get well-funded and will put attack ads on against their opponents in order to avoid the candidate themselves having to make the uncomfortable charge. That doesn't really help much to the integrity of the office that you're running for.
Right, right. But Bruce, so let me interrupt you here. This also feeds into the ethical concerns of campaign spending, right? Because you would think if you're running for an office, a lot of money is being spent on ads.
You would not only think that, it's absolutely astonishing. Back in 2015, there were two or three positions open on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And the total reported amount spent on that election was $15 million.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, that, at that time, set a world's record for money spent on a judicial campaign. However, just this past year, there was one position open on the Supreme Court, and the amount reported to be spent on that election was $17 million.
Holy smokes.
And this is just the sort of thing that you look at and you say, well, where is this money coming from? And what does this money earn for the person who contributed it?
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not the individual who received the money and is elected, they could be personally above reproach. They could be Caesar's wife. But to the system itself, does it not look like that whoever contributed a few of those $1 million, that if they happen to place a phone call, that call is going to be answered? And it creates an image over the court that I think invariably demeans its integrity. This was, I think, part of the reasoning why in the federal system way back at the founding, it was, no, we're going to have appointed judges, and they are going to be appointed for life. Yes, the appointment process has politics in it. There's no question about it.
Right.
You have to be a friend of the person doing the appointing to get appointed. People don't appoint their enemies, okay? But in the federal system, once you're appointed, you're there for life, unless you get impeached. So you don't necessarily have to owe homage to the person, and you don't have to run for office again for any reason. Mm. You don't have to build up a constituency. And this was one thing that many of the founders wrote was critical to the integrity of the judicial system, was its independence.
I see.
And that's what they thought that achieved.
So, Bruce, I mean, that's an excellent summary, the pros and cons. Is Pennsylvania an outlier, or are we in line with other states?
Well, it's about half and half.
Is
about
it?
Yes. About 30 states have some form of election of some of the members of the judiciary. Half the states elect their Supreme Courts. But half the states do not. Half the states use.
And is it a lifetime position if they're elected?
From what I can tell, in almost all states, the elected position comes up for a retention vote at some point in the future.
Okay.
So there is some further referendum that has to go back to the people, but. The thing that always is raised when people talk about this is, well, you know, could you ever have a system of appointment that would avoid just pure political patronage? You couldn't. But I think you could have a system that would filter at least some of that out. I think a system whereby people would have to have a fairly rigid set of qualifications that would be objectively determined and making them eligible for an appointment, rather than just having the law degree, which is basically all that you need right now to be theoretically eligible for an appointment. I think that process is out there somewhere if people have the will to investigate it. But I can tell you, the political system in Pennsylvania does not want that to happen.
Mm.
They are very, very comfortable having elections for judicial offices. And remember this, okay? This was something that has come up in the past. Every 10 years, when there is a new census, the state has to redraw the boundaries of the legislative districts. That program ultimately will end up in front of the Supreme Court. And there are many local politicians who will tell you that they want to make sure that they have one more than half of the members of their party on the Supreme Court when that happens.
Right.
because that's critical, not just to the judiciary, but that's critical to the legislative map of Pennsylvania.
Right. Okay, so we're talking to Bruce Ankowiak. He's a law professor at St. Vincent College. He joins us on a monthly basis to kind of open our eyes to stuff that we just, you know, not being in the legal profession would not think of. Bruce, you said that Pennsylvania is very, in your words, comfortable this way, electing judges. How is that observed? Like, what does that mean?
That means that, look, the phrase "all politics is local" has always been one of the great truths of this world. Mm-hmm. And people at the local level of politics love to become involved in judicial elections. Judicial elections are very common. They bring out the ability to draft individuals for wide-scale races. And they allow a political party to have very much considerable influence in a particular county. And people love elections. We have an embedded idea in Pennsylvania that exalts the electoral process over a great deal of other things. Mm-hmm. And we love to elect as many people as we possibly can. There was a movement on some time ago to start the election of the Secretary of State, which had always been an appointed job, but they wanted to talk about that. That would simply add yet another layer of politicking to an already heavily politic state.
Right. So, Bruce, you're a lawyer. You've taught law for many years. Do you have a dog in the hunt here? If you could, you know, wave your hand and make the perfect system, if such a thing existed, what would you do?
I would seriously explore the possibility of looking at an objective set of criteria that might even include a person who wanted to be a judge having to go to a special educational program and to be able to pass it. That would show that they had a true understanding of Pennsylvania law and procedure. Have them certified for that. At that point, though, it's going to have to be a matter of an appointed process. I don't think there's any other real way to do it, but I think there is a way to imbue the system with a certain degree of objective criteria that would allow us to have an assurance that whomever might be appointed is a person who truly has overall the qualifications to do it and a sense of independence. That's the most important thing, is that sense of independence. Now, I can tell you that the judges that I have known in my life desperately try to achieve that independence because they understand the perception of the public. Even in local county elections, it can cost somebody between $300,000 and $500,000 to run for a county judgeship.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And so, you know, when you get in, everybody's looking at you like, you know, well, where'd you get all that money from? Yeah. You know? You know, the people that I know hold their positions in great regard, and they don't want that. But inevitably, the jaundiced eye of the public is going to be cast upon that system, and that, to me, is very unfortunate.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's a fair assessment. I mean, you do know, of course, you know, the smoke-filled rooms of the old days. That does exist even still today, right? That there are always, and I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist or whatnot, or, you know, think about, you know, the shadow state and whatnot, but there are people behind the scenes who generally rule with more power than those who are elected.
No question. No, there always has been people who understand the inner workings of the system, but are never the people who are out front in public.
Yep.
They have always existed.
Right.
They do to this day.
Hmm. Well, Bruce, again, we're grateful for your presence on the show because this is something I just kind of accepted and never really thought about. Mm-hmm. So we appreciate the conversation today.
But you would not want to run for judge.
No, I'm not running for judge. I want
Bruce,
you to know that.
Want to throw your hat in the ring?
Listen, I did one time, and I got slaughtered. So You can call me biased for that purpose. I was slaughtered for all the legitimate reasons. I didn't know how to run for office. So.
I get it, right? I mean, it's a hard cross to bear.
Yeah, but the person who's a good judge and the person who is good at running for office, that might not be the same person.
That's true.
And that is not necessarily a confluence. That's correct.
Very good.
Yes.
Thank you, Bruce. Always a great pleasure.
All right. My pleasure. Thank you.
Bruce Ankowiak, he's a law professor at St. Vincent College. Really interesting. Always happy to have Bruce along with us. You go to a nice hotel to relax often, right? Something out of the ordinary.
Heck yeah.
Well, what about this? Would you be interested in doing this? There is an abandoned slate mine in Wales, and it's now billed as the world's deepest hotel. To get to the hotel, I put those in quotes, from the surface to your room takes a 4-hour journey. Down and down and down.
Who would want to do that?
Snowdonia, Wales. Of course, the Welsh countryside is beautiful. 1,400 feet underground.
I like how you say that the Welsh countryside is beautiful. Yeah, except that you're never seeing it.
You're not going to see it. You're going to see a dark hole. 1,400 feet underground to the world's deepest hotel. For 200 years, miners extracted slate from this mine, much of the work done by candlelight. In the process, they created a maze of tunnels, which are miles and miles and miles long. The exhausting journey to the Deep Sleep Hotel, which first opened in April of 2023.
That sounds like death, by the way.
Takes 4 hours plus. Guests arrive at the hotel to find a climate-controlled cabins, and groundwater helps generate electricity. There's Wi-Fi, a bathroom. Running water comes from a spring, but there is no shower. Dinner comes in a pouch. You can't pass this up, said Mark Green. It's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. The price tag to get some deep sleep in a cabin for two, $500 a night.
That's absolutely the craziest thing I'd ever heard. I couldn't be less interested in anything.
I agree. I told you years ago.
I'd rather hang by my ankles from the ceiling of this studio.
To walk down to your hotel room.
There's just, who would?
I did a training video on mine safety years ago. Those miners, man.
Oh,
they
talk
earn
about
their money. And, of course, mining's changed a lot, but you know, because of heavy machinery.
Right.
But still, to go in there day after day after day and be surrounded by darkness, no thank you.
I was in a coal mine in Scranton.
Yeah.
We took my husband and I took a tour of, it was maybe 2 hours long, so it was pretty considerable. You spent a lot of time down there. It was very well done, and it blew my mind.
Yeah.
I mean, our country, it goes without saying, I guess, but I'm going to say it, how much we owe to the laborers that did that.
Yep.
I mean, they
still doing
they
it.
Powered the Industrial Revolution.
Yep. And still.
On their stomachs.
Yep.
And on their knees and buying their own. The fact that you had to buy your own stuff, like the people who own the mine basically, oh, we'll allow you to work here, but yeah. You have to get your own pick. You have to get your own. What kind of gig is that?
It's crazy. One of my favorite movies is called Mate Wan.
It's a great movie.
Fabulous film. And it tells the story of miners in West Virginia in the 1910s, 1915s, mm-hmm. It's a town that goes on a mining strike. It's a brutal, beautiful film.
Yep.
But to think about that, I mean.
And it portrays it's more like brotherhood. I was going to say camaraderie.
Yeah.
But the work is so hard, camaraderie is just inappropriate.
Oh, my gosh.
So the brotherhood they felt because of the shared risk that they all had doing it every day. And the type of top-down ownership that the mine owners had and the management took with them, that movie really opened my eyes. In fact, we watched it 2 days after we went on the mine tour.
Oh, did you?
So that I could, because I really felt like I needed to get that
excellent,
in my head.
Yeah.
I just didn't understand that.
I mean, they controlled everything, right? The mining towns, you slept in their houses, on their mattresses.
You bought
their
groceries.
Food. Yeah.
Yep.
What is this song? 16 tons, and what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. Yeah. It's curious to think about how much coal is exported from this country to China.
Yeah.
I mean, still to this day,
right.
We are running a dirty coal world, even as we, you know, aspire to clean energy and all the different aspects of what that looks like.
Yeah.
Anyway, all that to say, would you ever go into a mine to stay at a hotel for $500 a night and eat a meal out of a pouch?
That doesn't even make any sense. I mean, it's just absolutely wretched.
That's a heck of a way to end the show.
Sorry.
But we are going to end the show right here. Hey, listen, the podcast is up and running after we leave the show. We're all over the place, so you can find us easily. And always a great pleasure to have you with us. We don't take it for granted at so ever.
Right. You have a lot of choices on your radio dial.
So thank you so much for being with us. Have yourself a great day. Hope you get out there and in this evening hours, still enjoy the beautiful sunshine. We'll see you tomorrow, God willing.
The Ride Home with John and Kathy, a production of Salem Media Group.